From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
I'm Bob Garfield, and this week we're starting a little differently with a couple of letters from last week. The issue was Israel's recent unprecedented crackdown on the press. Robert Smith of Dallas thought our treatment insightful and added, "For many historical and sometimes legitimate reasons, the Israeli government gets a pass on a lot of things. On restricting press coverage, selectively granting press credentials based on religion, nationality, or affiliation, no passes should be given to their government or any other."
But listener George Bulow criticized journalists for applying a double standard when issuing complaints. "Within the last 2 weeks," he writes, "we have seen Reuters correspondents who witnessed and videotaped the summary execution of collaborators by Palestinian authorities, having their tapes confiscated and their lives threatened. Little, if anything, was reported by NPR or by any other Western media outlets. Yet everyone, on the media included, jumped on the bandwagon to bash the Israelis for closing certain areas of military activity to a prying press." So, do the media hold Israel to a different standard, condemning it for actions we tolerate from the Palestinian Authority? Joel Simon of the Committee to Protect Journalists joins us now. So, Joel, I assume you'll say no, there is no double standard.
Well, it's a little more complicated. I mean, from our vantage point, we simply document the cases as they come our way. Since the incursion began, we've documented two serious press freedom violations by the Palestinian Authority. One you just mentioned, another one in which Palestinian militia shot a car that was clearly identified as a car full of journalists. Apparently that was a mistake, but that we did nevertheless document that. On the other hand, in the last few weeks, we've documented probably about 8 or 10 shooting incidents carried out by Israeli Defense Forces against journalists, and many, many other cases of harassment, restricting access, threats. So we're just looking at the cases themselves, and that's what we've documented.
Do you think that Palestinian censorship is reported with equal intensity?
I think that in some ways, because Palestinian censorship tends to affect local Palestinian journalists, it's a more subtle kind of event, whereas the shootings of journalists by Israeli forces have affected foreign correspondents and are inherently newsworthy.
But a lot of these incidents regarding the Palestinian Authority are by no means subtle and are by no means limited to Palestinian journalists.
And we've certainly documented after the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon in September, there were celebrations, especially in Nablus, street demonstrations, and the Palestinian Authority tried to restrict coverage of those demonstrations and in some cases threatened journalists and confiscated film. We protested that vigorously, and I know that that was widely covered.
Is there a difference between the way the Palestinian Authority and the Israeli Defense Force deal with the press?
Well, yes, there's a difference. You have to start with the understanding that Palestinian journalists and journalists in the areas controlled by the Palestinian Authority work in an environment in which censorship, self-censorship, intimidation is the norm. And Israeli journalists work in a much freer environment. And part of the process through which Palestinian journalists are censored or engage in self-censorship is very informal. It involves relationships, it involves phone calls that seem friendly, it involves meetings, and precisely for that reason, it's much more difficult to document, and we don't always hear the complaints. Israeli journalists are much more likely to speak up.
So even though, say, Saudi Arabia or North Korea are far more closed societies and far more susceptible to charges of censorship, you're not as likely to go after them because you don't have the complaints.
Well, that's right. We don't take up a lot of press freedom cases in Iraq. We acknowledge that there's almost complete censorship in Iraq, but we don't have individual cases. The question also is one of sensitivity. I mean, shouldn't a country that's democratic expect and respond to these kinds of complaints? I mean, does Israel really only want to be compared to Saudi Arabia? Now, you can describe that as a double standard, but it's also a situation in which governments create their own standards. A democratic government, a government that permits its citizens to speak up and protest and demonstrate, will obviously create a situation in which citizens are vocal in expressing their displeasure.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Joel Simon is the Deputy Director of the Committee to Protect Journalists.
The Minneapolis Star Tribune is getting a lot of attention lately for its Middle East coverage, not for what it's printing, but rather for what it's not printing. A group of Jewish leaders are protesting the paper for its reluctance to refer to Palestinian suicide bombers as terrorists. The Star Tribune is not alone in this policy. The New York Times, Washington Post, and even Associated Press all avoided the T word when describing a recent bombing in a restaurant in Haifa. This is a marked shift in word usage from before September 11th. The Times, Post, and AP had no problem using the words terrorist and terrorism in their coverage of the August 9th Sbarro Pizza Shop bombing in Jerusalem. Joining us now to discuss the swing is Michael Kelly, editor of the Atlantic Monthly and a columnist for the Washington Post. Mike, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you very much.
Well, the objectivity argument is that the word terrorist is just too loaded at this stage. Whether journalists are using it less or not, the newsmakers are using it more and more as a tool of rhetoric. Isn't it possible that the word has become so politicized and so haphazardly detonated, let's say, that it's just lost the clarity and precision that commended its use in the first place?
First of all, I'd say that it's always been politically loaded because it expresses what you might call a politically loaded fact. Blowing up civilians is necessarily controversial. But it doesn't seem to me that those of us in the press add anything to clarity or honesty by declining to use the term just because it's loaded and by substituting terms that we know are imprecise or even dishonest euphemisms.
All right, but suicide bombing does the trick. It's descriptive not of the strategy, like terrorism is, but of the act itself.
But it still does not go as far in accuracy or in honesty as terrorist does because it does not imply motive. Why does a suicide bomber in Palestine blow up a restaurant? Because he believes that by doing so, he may force the state of Israel to capitulate in what is a real, if unconventional, war. That suicide bomber is, by any definition, a terrorist who is practicing terrorism. What's to be gained by not saying that?
Well, let's talk about impact for a minute then.
Mm-hmm.
If the idea is not to be taken for pro-Israeli mouthpieces, couldn't the media be correct in judging that for their reports to be taken at all seriously and not to be dismissed as propaganda or one-sided, that the sacrifice of the difference between suicide bomber and terrorist is a small one to make?
I think the argument that you're making is probably the argument that news editors make to themselves as a legitimate argument, but I still think it's a fallacy. I'll use an analogy, the term fascist. If you were a reporter during the Second World War, covering it for an American or British newspaper, you would frequently notice that the spokespeople for your government called the enemy a fascist, and they used it to remind people that this was the enemy. It would still be appropriate for a reporter in that instance to use the term fascist, precisely because the term fascist had a real meaning, and in fact was a term that had been defined by the fascists themselves. That's the situation we're in now, it seems to me.
So what would you prescribe?
It's a good question. You made me think about it as an editor, not as a columnist. I would prescribe a mixed use of terrorist and suicide bombers.
Well, curiously enough, this seems to have been the decision that news organizations made right up through September 10th.
Uh-huh.
Then immediately after, there was a big upsurge in the invocation of the word terrorism. And then when the latest, most violent uprising in the occupied territories and in Israel, all of a sudden it went away. Why do you suppose that this is such a moving target?
Well, news organizations, these are in fact entities that are very sensitive to all sorts of pressure. There has always been an organized lobbying campaign on all sides of that issue over matters of terminology. And after September 11th, you did not see a great deal of pressure on American news organizations to resist the use of the word terrorist. So now, as opposed to the coverage of September 11th, news organizations, in describing exactly the same activity, face a different political reality, which is that they are under much more pressure.
Well, Michael Kelly, thank you very much.
It was my pleasure.
Mike Kelly is the editor of Atlantic Monthly and a columnist for The Washington Post.
You heard a couple of your letters at the top of the show. Now we'll try to squeeze in a few more. Victor H. Cohn of Kensington, Maryland, writes that he was truly dismayed by our report on the pain game developed by German art students. This represents the mentality we associate with SS troops in the Nazi era. Ugh! That such thinking persists and gets credence through your broadcast is sickening.
Mike Kristoff of Metro Networks in Milwaukee writes to say that he found our story on Metro Networks to be balanced, but responds this way to the critic who condemned the deception that makes remote radio newscasters seem local. Radio, he writes, is as much about the theater of the mind as actual content. When your critic says some of our anchors use phony names, it is merely a device so that it doesn't appear that the same person is on several stations. The client stations dictate style, length, and other factors. You can be sure that in today's world of ownership consolidation, if Metro wasn't doing what it does, someone else would be. And if Metro wasn't offering the product and no one else was, then many of our client stations wouldn't do news at all.
Susan Berger of San Francisco found our interview on Clear Channel to be, quote, quite interesting, but was bothered by the ending. After a long discussion with Eric Bollert about the monopolistic character of Clear Channel, she writes, Bob Garfield asked what was left out there for radio listeners. Mr. Bollert answered by saying there were three options. One, public radio, at which point Mr. Garfield interjected with thanks in a humorous tone, the music revved up, and we never heard the two other options. Perhaps you could include those options on next week's show?
Well, thanks, Susan, for getting the joke, which others did not, and for your suggestions. In fact, I have in my hand the other alternatives for listeners suggested by Mr. Bollert: after public radio, internet radio, satellite radio, and he added a fourth, college radio.
We take suggestions here at On the Media, sometimes. So send them to onthemedia@wnyc.org, and don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name.
Coming up, the FBI's new gag order, the fall and rise of Louis Rukeyser, and the Hollywood trials of a would-be host.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
Back with OTM. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The Colorado Supreme Court ruled this week that a bookstore did not have to tell the police the name of a person who had purchased two instructional books about making drugs. The unanimous decision assures booksellers and librarians in the Centennial State that they need not turn over their sales or checkout records to the authorities.
But there's no such assurance nationwide because privacy protection of what a person buys or reads varies from state to state. And the USA Patriot Act, passed shortly after September 11th in an effort to combat terrorism, now permits the FBI to seize what it vaguely defines as any tangible things, including those sales or checkout records. Why haven't you heard about it? The law also forbids librarians and booksellers from telling anyone else, be it a reporter, neighbor, or 14-month-old daughter, if the FBI has come a searching in their place of business. Lynn Bradley is the Director of Government Relations for the American Library Association. She says the Patriot Act greatly expands the kinds of records the FBI can search.
Before the Patriot Act, they were more almost common carrier types of information. Phone records, hotel records, whether you rented a car. But now, under the larger term called business records, it can be any tangible item. And in the case of a library situation, it might be the hard disk or the whole computer from an online system that the library operates, or anything down to the clipboard with a sign-on sheet that often our patrons use to sign up to take their turn to use a public terminal in a library.
Do you know of any cases where a computer or a hard drive has been seized?
We have had reports, and I must say they are unverified because of the gag rule, where I believe two different terminals were removed from a library.
But in the meantime, when law enforcement goes over the contents of the hard drive, they will find the information that the suspect has generated there, and in addition, all of the dozens or hundreds of other citizens have generated there.
We're very concerned that we are not able to confirm or deny just what leniency the FBI or whatever investigatory agency has access to all of these other files of other library users and so forth. And that's one of the things where, in terms of the gag order, doesn't allow for public accountability. Librarians, just like every other sector of our country, want to follow the law. They want to do the right thing. At the same time, we owe it to our country to protect certain basic rights, which indeed we're fighting this war for. And we are very concerned that this kind of broad-ranging access to all kinds of business records compromises that anonymity and that sense of confidence that the library is going to be a safe and personal space to be used without undue and inappropriate fishing expeditions into the user's activities.
What about the gag order itself as an impingement on First Amendment rights? Is it legal? Can an entire class of citizens be placed under prior restraint of free speech rights?
That's the hard question. One way that we look at it is that we're kind of in the preschool phase. We have not had a lot of court cases. At some point, there will be leaks, there will be court cases, there will be people charged, but I think it's going to take a while.
All right. Well, if you would kindly memo your member libraries and tell them that if an FBI agent comes knocking on the door inquiring about stuff that I've looked at on their computers, you know, I was doing some research for my cousin.
Oh, okay. All right.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Lynn Bradley is Director of Government Relations for the American Library Association. If you think the USA Patriot Act's provisions targeted at books is unnecessary, consider a book on how to create anthrax spores. And there is a book distributor, Lumpanix, that happens to specialize in all texts subversive. Here are some catchy titles being offered in their spring catalog. Your Revenge is in the Mail, Fake ID by Mail and Modem, Advanced Lock-Picking Secrets, Prison Killing Techniques, and, of course, The Heroin User's Handbook. President Michael Hoy spends a good amount of time defending the books he sells, and he joins us now. Mr. Hoy, welcome to OTM.
Good morning.
All right, let me first clarify. As far as I know, you haven't actually published a book on how to produce anthrax spores, am I correct?
No, we have not.
But would you?
I think I would, except I'm worried about some of these new laws that have been passed. That would be the only thing that would stop me. There's already lots and lots of cookbooks on weapons of mass destruction out there.
Stuff which actually you do sell, right?
Yes, I sell some CIA bomb-making books.
All right, now I'm just guessing here, but if I were a betting man, I would say that you've probably just really made a lot of our listeners angry. Aren't you afraid that you're giving people who want to harm society the means to produce far more devastation than they would have if they had never had access to these books and manuals?
No. I'm offering every American the opportunity to learn anything he wants to about any subject he wants to learn about. I feel the world is a much better place if there's as many books on as many subjects in as many hands as possible.
What about books on how to procure children for pedophilia purposes? Would that upset you?
Actually, I do have a book like that, except it's written kind of from the other way, how children can protect themselves. But in order to do that, they have to know, you know, how a pedophile is going to approach them.
So if you were a pedophile looking for pointers, this might be a reasonable source for you.
Yes, I would think any pedophile worth the name of pedophile would be reading all the How to Protect Your Children books that he could and read them backwards.
All right, so I think what you do is disgraceful. Please explain to me why what you do is not disgraceful.
I believe this book was published by HarperCollins. Are you going to call HarperCollins up and harangue them for assisting pedophiles? You're telling me it's perfectly legal activities or something I should be ashamed of? Reading books, publishing books? I think you should if you actually think there's something wrong with that.
Well, it seems to me that what you sell creates exactly the dilemma that legislators and law enforcement face in times like these. Because on the one hand, almost by definition, the Patriot Act limits the very freedoms upon which this country was founded. On the other hand, when someone can go onto the web and purchase how-to manuals for creating destruction, it's certainly clear why the government would have an interest in knowing who's buying those things.
This is what America's all about. That's what our First Amendment says. It doesn't say the only things it can publish are stuff that the FBI approves of. It is not Osama bin Laden, nor is it the Taliban, nor is it Saddam Hussein, who wants to have the FBI go around to librarians and snoop into what their customers are reading, and then, under a provision in this Patriot Act, throw them in jail if they even tell anybody about it.
Yeah, all they want to do is just kill us. Do you see no difference between rights and responsibilities?
Well, there are no rights without responsibilities. But you're saying that if somebody bought a book from me that was titled How to Beat Your Mother-in-Law's Head In with a Sledgehammer, and then he went and did it, that I would somehow be responsible for that, even though I might never have met this person in my life. And no, I don't feel that I would have any responsibility any more than the hardware store owner who sold him the sledgehammer. I mean, where would you draw the line? How about somebody who works in the print shop that printed the book?
Not interested in discussing it any further. I want to thank you very much for taking the time to join us, and all worst of luck.
Well, thank you very much, Bob.
Michael Hoy is the president of an extreme libertarian publishing company whose books probably don't appear in your local library.
When CNBC announced this week that it had hired Louis Rukeyser to host a program essentially identical to PBS's Wall Street Week, from which he was recently eliminated after 32 years, there was a surprise twist. In addition to its slot on CNBC, Rukeyser's new show will be distributed free of charge to public TV stations. To accommodate the dual distribution, CNBC won't run standard commercials within the show, but instead will air it with sponsor messages in the format of public broadcasting underwriting announcements. Bob wondered what that arrangement may tell us about the strange animal called enhanced underwriting.
Okay, listen. Here's a piece of a TV commercial for Archer Daniels Midland Corporation.
Our crowded planet has something to say. ADM believes that for every problem, nature has an answer.
Now, here from a PBS show is what they call an enhanced underwriting credit.
Imagine a world where no child begs for food. While some will look on that as a dream, others will look long and hard and get to work. ADM, the nature of what's to come.
You didn't see the eye-catching animation, but it's there. The striking similarity between enhanced underwriting and naked advertising has fueled controversy ever since 1995. That's when public broadcasters, their federal funding threatened by Republicans in Congress, loosened restrictions on underwriters' messages. They are still limited to 15 seconds. They can't interrupt programming, and they can't directly solicit consumer action, but in other respects, they are indistinguishable. Furthermore, critics of public broadcasting commercialization are fearful of what enhanced underwriting represents, namely the temptation to abandon public broadcasting's mission for the sake of ever larger audiences and the lucrative sponsorships that come with them. Andrew J. Schwartzman is a lawyer with a telecommunications public interest group called the Media Access Project.
We should care because public broadcasting exists to fill needs that are not met on the commercial side. But the incentives are driving public broadcasters to look for ways to serve audiences that are already adequately served that advertisers can reach. Unfortunately, we should be looking to serve the niche audiences.
So along comes CNBC's announcement about Rukeyser's double-duty underwriting messages, and the critics go, aha!
The fact that CNBC is willing to accept what passes as enhanced underwriting on public television is as being sufficient as a commercial for its own viewers offers a lot of insight into what CNBC thinks a commercial is.
In other words, if it looks like a duck and it quacks like a duck and commercial advertisers are ordering duck, maybe it's a duck.
No, I don't think it's a duck.
Terrell Cast is general manager of WLIW-TV, the Long Island station that's distributing Rukeyser's CNBC show to PBS stations. Cast says he has a very duck-sensitive audience that would be running into the fields with shotguns if they heard a threat to public broadcasting's mission flying overhead.
I've honestly never gotten a letter. I get a lot of letters for different complaints, but I've never received one on enhanced underwriting.
Over at CNBC, they're actually wondering about the flip side of the question. If underwriting credits can satisfy advertisers even with all their restrictions, there may be a commercial potential to less commercialism.
It just might work.
Bruno Cohen is Executive Vice President for Business Programming at CNBC.
If programs can be produced by creating a different kind of viewing experience, one that isn't interrupted periodically by commercials and other kinds of messages, if those interruptions can be limited, if that gives a more enhanced viewing experience, which may enhance viewership, it may mean that advertisers and sponsors and underwriters may see themselves as willing to pay premiums to be one of a few products or services associated with the program that's in their interest. I think all the better. It'll make television better for everybody.
Mainly, though, CNBC is banking on the quacks like a duck quality of the enhanced underwriting credit to attract enough commercial advertisers to make a satisfactory profit on the Rukeyser deal. And the network doesn't much care what you call the 50-second spots that fund it.
That form has evolved over time on PBS, so it's not as though they don't have interesting video that supports sort of, you know, showing the products and services of the company. And the 15 seconds of copy that they get gets to describe the attributes of the company. If you want to call that a commercial, you're into semantics.
And if you're really into semantics, visit Semantics World, providing fine words and their significance for nearly half a decade. At Semantics World, we know the meaning of meaning. Call now. Operators are standing by.
The reason why Louis Rukeyser was deposed from his throne at Public TV's long-lived Wall Street Week is that he, too, is long-lived. In other words, old, or at least in the view of the show's producers, too old to attract a younger audience. Jeff Colt, an actor recently relocated to New York from Hollywood, has had his share of rejection, or ejection, from the host chair. Jeff, you weren't fired for the same reason as Rukeyser, were you?
No, but oddly enough, Brooke, it was similar. I like to refer to it as the thick affair. We're all familiar with the game show Who Wants to Be a Millionaire?
Mm-hmm.
And who doesn't? And it was a great idea, but Regis Philbin single-handedly undermined the entire industry.
How did he do that?
Well, when Regis's show became the number one show on ABC, everybody thought, it's not just a hip show. They love Regis, because Regis was saving the network. And Regis is 70. 75, something like that. And then everybody thought, you know what? I think everybody wants the father figure again. I auditioned for this game show called Three's a Crowd, and they wanted young and hip. It's a dating show. And have you seen the dating shows?
Some of them.
Yeah. They're pretty risque, a lot of them. And mine was particularly offensive, where you'd actually pit one ex-boyfriend against a current boyfriend, and you'd find out who was better in bed, and you'd ask in front of the girl. It was just lowbrow.
Yeah.
You know.
Okay.
And they hired me for the show because I'm lowbrow enough. And then I got the call. I booked the show and we did the pilot and it was terrific. And then I got the call from my agent saying that I'd been replaced And I said, why had I been replaced? And they came up with an idea. And Hollywood's most annoying because it's much like dating in that you'll never get an honest answer from anybody. You know, it's like a blind date. Everybody breaks up with you, and it's never because of you. It's something else.
Oh, but, so they said it's not you, it's us?
Well, right. Obviously, it's me. And originally, they'd come up with the idea. They said you were too nervous during the commercial breaks. During the commercial break, what is this, 1952? I'm doing Camel Spots Live. I could vomit my shoes during the commercials. I'm fine. And they said, well, actually, we're going with Alan Thicke.
Not a young man.
No, no disrespect. He's a talented guy. I saw Chicago. He's sure he can tap. He's great. He's at least 55 if he's a day. When was that sitcom he did? 1978, 82? Kirk Cameron is 46 now. Alan Thicke is an older man, and the dating show was so beneath him. So they replaced me with Alan Thicke, and I was just incensed by the whole affair. And it was explained to me that a lot had to do with Regis. Good old Regis.
Uh-huh.
They wanted older.
They wanted older. Now, that wasn't the only time you were rejected as a talk show host.
No, there have been other hosting opportunities for me to be rejected. I've had some success, but the few that really resonate are the rejections because of, as I said, the dumbness in which they try to deflect the fact that you're being rejected. At no point will an executive ever sit you down and say, well, to be honest, Jeff, the reason you're not getting the job is, well, quite frankly, you suck. And every now and then you need one of those just to know. And I actually had pitched a show to MTV. And I went in there, and we had a great pitch. I went in there with a partner. We pitched a show. It was a great show. And pitching myself as the host, I have a lot of hosting experience. And I'm quick on my feet and fairly affable. And it all went very well. And the next day, they called me for a meeting at a coffee shop. And you know you're in trouble when you're having a meeting at a coffee shop. It's like when a girl calls you at home and she knows you're at work. So she doesn't want to get you. Coffee shop is easy because they can just skirt in and out because they're never going to sit with you for longer than a cup of coffee. And the executive...
And they're not going to be picking up a big check.
No, either. It's $1.40. And you put in vanilla syrup, it's $1.80. That's it. And they write it off. And she sits me down, this woman from MTV, a lovely woman, a fine network. I would love to work for them. At some point, she says to me, we love the show, but unfortunately, you're not going to work out. And I said, why not? Why wouldn't I work out? I'm the host of the show. And she said, well... They seem to feel you have too broad of a mass appeal.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's what I said. Oh, that must be good. But I had to ask her to explain it because, again, I didn't get it. I said, please repeat that. She said, you have too broad of a mass appeal. I said, correct me if I'm wrong. Does that mean I'm too likable? She said, yeah. So I said, you want unlikable hosts? She said, yeah. That would explain Danny Bonaducci. But as an industry standard, that makes no sense. Who wants to? I don't get it. I could be sexier. I could be more unlikable. Just tell me to be something. But to say I'm too likable, it was very disheartening.
Well, Jeff, it really has been a pleasure talking to you. The truth is you're actually too interesting for public radio, so I don't think this is going to work out. But thanks for coming in.
Thank you, and my best wishes to Lewis.
Jeff Colt is an actor, recently relocated to New York City after a really tough time out in L.A.
Coming up, why we hate Barney and why we should love Speedy Gonzalez. Also, why Celine Dion is un-PC.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
Back with On the Media, I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. A proposed law prepared by Senator Ernest Hollings of South Carolina amounts to a new salvo in a war between two powerful industries, One produces entertainment, and the other, the technology to disseminate it. Fear that the consumers of music and movies could get something for nothing has motivated the lawmaker to insist that computer makers build in technology that prevents copying. This obviously benefits the entertainment industry at the expense of computers, but also, it seems, at the expense of the economy, because while Hollywood generates, according to one estimate, about $40 billion a year, computer technology generates in the neighborhood of $600 billion. We've invited NPR's Rick Carr to come in and explain how this would work. Welcome to the show, Rick.
Thanks, Brooke. It's great to be here.
This Copyright Protection Act that Hollings proposes, how would it work?
Well, the way the language in the law is drafted, it says that any device that would accept a digital input and has a digital output that could be used to copy something that's copyrighted must have a copy protection scheme in it. Nobody's really sure how this would work out. What it's clear that the entertainment industries want, though, is digital television, say, music, ideally, and movies on DVDs, impossible to copy onto your computer hard drive or onto another CD or DVD.
There is a certain presumption here that all copiers are pirates.
That's absolutely right. The recording industry points at a fairly disastrous 2001, sales down by about 10%. They point to Napster. They say it's all Napster's fault. But you know, a lot of people I know who are friends of mine who are rock critics and music critics and who care passionately about music say, look, there were a lot of bad albums that were put out. The economy hit the dumps. We had September 11th, which kind of put us all out of a frame of mind in which we wanted to celebrate with music and movies. Yeah, there is this kind of blurring of the line that, you know, copying is always bad when in a lot of ways, I mean, I have photocopies in front of me right here. And in theory, if it were a digital photocopier, Senator Hollings' bill would have prevented me from copying this very piece of paper I'm holding right now.
You mentioned the Napster example. They got rid of Napster, but there were plenty of other similar technologies that came in to take its place that they can't get rid of. So is it even possible to suppress this, what seems to be innate urge to copy?
I don't know that it's possible to suppress it. I think that it's possible to minimize the degree to which it goes on. I mean, there are an awful lot of people in the digital music field who will say, look, most people don't steal cable TV now. Why don't they steal cable? Because, except in New York City anyway, the prices are fairly reasonable and it feels like it's free. You turn it on and it's there. These people encourage the music industry to kind of take the same look at music. Look, create services that feel like they're free, that don't overcharge people. And you know what? People won't have the incentive to copy anymore. They'll be able to get what they want.
Actually, Hollywood did have the same fears about the VCR when it was invented, and the response wasn't to prohibit VCRs or to impose federal technology mandates on them. Eventually, Hollywood figured out a way to make money from the new technology by adjusting their business model. Isn't that what they should be doing now?
They have a business model that works more or less for them right now, and everybody is afraid of change. Nobody wants to see their entire business model destroyed overnight by a new technology. Having said that, you're right. Jack Valenti did say to Congress back during hearings about the video cassette recorder that it is to the American movie industry what the Boston Strangler is to a woman alone. And of course, I think last year was the first year in which videotape and DVD rentals actually generated more revenue for Hollywood than box office receipts did.
Well, now it appears we have one of the first freelance efforts, not mandated by law, to protect the copying of music. And it's the new, incredibly well-selling Celine Dion release. This is the first time Sony Music has admitted to using copyright protection software. How does that work?
I'm really glad that your producers didn't force me to listen to the record before we did this. The way it works...
Wait a second.
Have you ever been in love?
The way it works is that a home CD player is basically designed to play a messed up CD. You know, say you toss it in the back seat of your car, you bring it home, you stick it in the home CD player. It's designed to play a schmutzy CD, one that's scratched up, one that has errors in
because,
it.
Because if they were too persnickety, they wouldn't be able to play anything.
Exactly. The second that you got one scratch on your CD, it just wouldn't work anymore. So the home CD players are fairly robust. Computer CD players are designed to read computer programs as much as they're designed to read audio, so they are more prone to being put off track by these deliberate errors that are introduced. So the idea is you can take the CD, put it in your home CD player, you can listen to it just fine, you can make a cassette tape of it just fine, but the second that you put it into your computer and try to make a bit-for-bit copy of it onto your hard drive, the CD drawer in the computer says, there's something wrong with this, I can't play this. so you can't make the copy. Now, some computers are more robust and can play it, so it's inconsistent. Now, the interesting thing is that the record companies tried to all get together. They tried to form this thing called the Secure Digital Music Initiative so that they would all use the same technology. They failed miserably at this. They couldn't get off page one, and finally the whole initiative was just taken apart last year, and the record companies have said, we're going to go it alone. The motion picture and television industries learned from that experience, and they realized that without a little bit of help from Washington, they were never going to get the technologists to get off page one. So the sort of conventional wisdom on Fritz Hollings' bill is that it's not so much something that Hollywood and the record companies want to see part of law. It's a way of forcing the technologists to negotiate with them to come up with a standard. And in fact, last week and early this week, News Corporation and Disney released statements saying that they were happy to see that the computer industry and the consumer electronics industry were finally sitting down with them to come up with ways to deal with the two most pressing problems they face. Now that the technologists are actually sitting down and talking with them, they may not need to push quite as hard for Fritz Hollings' bill.
Yeah, but without the bill, this marriage can't last.
Well, you know, and that's something that a lot of people in the technology community say. And in fact, if you look at the big motion picture studios and record companies, you realize that a lot of these companies have hedged their bets. They've laid money on both sides of the table. Sony, for instance, makes DVD players, makes movies. AOL Time Warner builds the data pipe into your home, makes movies and records. Disney, to some extent, is that way. So everybody's kind of trying to hedge their bets because nobody knows how this is going to work out.
Well, thanks a lot, Rick.
You're quite welcome, Brooke.
NPR cultural correspondent Rick Carr.
Children's television has long been a big, fat target. Consider Eddie Murphy's send-up of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood on Saturday Night Live, and more recently, The Simpsons, cigar-chomping Krusty the Clown character, and his cohort Sideshow Bob, now serving time in Springfield Penitentiary for assorted crimes too despicable to list here. Currently on Fox TV's Greg the Bunny, furry puppets behave in shocking ways, and the big-screen satire Death to Smoochie offers a sinister look behind the scenes of kiddie shows full of drug-abusing has-beens, thugs, degenerates, and psychopaths. Smoochie got Aaron Gell to wondering exactly why adults so loathe what their children love.
As the parent of a four-year-old, Sophie, who is, like most of her peers, a fanatical viewer of children's television, I'll admit to feeling a twinge of perverse pleasure at the sight of the dead Barney stand-in on Death to Smoochie's Subway advertising. Of course, I didn't dare admit that to my daughter. Turn off the radio, honey. In the film, Robin Williams plays a dissolute children's show host who loses his time slot to Smoochie the Rhino.
But it's the Rhino, Angie. The devil sent him from hell to destroy me. Smoochie is the face of evil.
In addition to some really scathing reviews, the film has brought protests and the threat of a lawsuit from the makers of a Canadian kiddie show called Ricky's Room, which also happens to star a costumed rhinoceros. So exactly how accurate is Death to Smoochie? I asked an expert.
I can draw a parallel from almost all those scenes down to what it's like to really be on a kids' TV show. So some of it was right on the money.
Don't recognize the voice? Maybe you'd like...
A clue, a clue!
My inside source is none other than Steve Burns, who since 1996 has been one of the most popular children's entertainers on the planet as the adorably boyish star of Nickelodeon's highly rated series Blue's Clues. On April 29th, in the kid vid equivalent of Johnny Carson's historic farewell, Burns will head off to college, or so the world's children will be told. Actually, he's recorded a CD and hopes to reinvent himself as an indie rock singer-songwriter.
I have a question. If you're going away to college, who's going to live here with us?
That is a good question.
The answer is Donovan Patton, a young actor who will be introduced during a three-part special that's been carefully designed to offer children the most painless transition possible. Given this concern for young viewers, perhaps it's no surprise that Steve Burns does not number himself among the fans of Death to Smoochie.
The movie was kind of one big joke, and they just kept playing that joke over and over again. So you see the kid show host who, as soon as the camera goes off, he talks like this. All of a sudden, he's got a different voice, you know. And then you see the mandatory, creepy, strung-out, retired kid show host who is on heroin.
Clearly, there's something about the tireless good cheer of kids' TV that we just don't trust.
I have a bread, and it's called Pumpernickel. Yum, yum, Pumpernickel, Pumpernickel bread. Hey!
Children's superstar Barney has come in for particular venom. The internet abounds with Barney-hating sites, and beating up on the purple dinosaur has become a sort of national pastime, something the San Diego Chicken, the Padres mascot, proved when he made the pummeling of a Barney lookalike a centerpiece of his ballgame routine. Blue's Clues Steve Burns.
I understand it. I more than understand and can appreciate how something that is that repetitive and something that is that sing-song and overly saccharine is annoying to an adult sensibility. But I think the reaction is completely out of proportion for the sin.
So what's it all about? Why all this adult hostility toward shows that are plainly meant for toddlers?
The message on the Barney Show is like 100% kindness, sweetness, and social caring. And I think that for some parents and adults, this is almost too much to handle. It may make them feel guilty that they're not offering that much love and attention as Barney is willing to give.
Dorothy Singer is a developmental psychologist. In her role as co-director of Yale University's Family Television Research Center, she's watched every single episode of Barney.
Many people have this notion that young children need to be exposed to some of the cruel realities of the world, or they're going to suffer later on when they enter school, and I don't agree with that at all.
Blue's Clues Steve Burns.
The truth is that life is hard, and sometimes it's sad, and it can be pretty disappointing. Now, we wouldn't ever want to convey that to our children via a television show, obviously. But there are people who seem to be very angry when children's television show aggressively presents this kind of high fructose saccharine view of a utopian world that adults, cynically, can't accept anymore.
The new sitcom Greg the Bunny features a menagerie of puppets, including an alcoholic ape, who are every bit as troubled as their human counterparts.
Hi, Mr. Bender. My name is Greg the... oh, my God! Professor Ape!
yes, actually, the name's Warren de Montague. Okay, real guy standing here, not TV time.
Sorry, it's just that, I mean, I love you. I've seen everything you've ever done. Godspell, Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat.
Yes, well, you know, if it was lame and about Jesus, I was there.
Greg the Bunny co-creator and star Dan Milano.
The only other thing you'd have that was comparable to it would be a religious icon of some kind, something that the masses generally put on a pedestal and see as something good and decent and pure. And the biggest punk impulse is to just tear that down.
No doubt my daughter Sophie has a few years to go before giving into that particular punk impulse. But she will. And it is precisely because of that inevitability that I'm grateful to children's television for providing so many ripe targets. Better she tear down Barney than tear down Dad. For On the Media, I'm Aaron Gell.
People who follow children's television closely may have noticed that Ted Turner's Cartoon Network has stopped broadcasting the old Warner Brothers Speedy Gonzalez cartoons. When asked about the absence of the fastest mouse in all Mexico from their airwaves, Cartoon Network officials admitted that Speedy was no longer part of their lineup, partly because he wasn't very popular, but mostly because of the cartoon's offensive portrayal of Mexicans. This triggered a variety of exasperated protests from Latino groups in the United States who claim that Speedy's cartoons offer positive and heroic images of Mexicans in U.S. culture. Adrian Viejas is an Austin-based comic whose one-man show is called Six Mexicans Named Gonzalez, and he joins us now to talk about his personal take on Speedy. So, Adrian, what is your personal take on Speedy?
Well, I didn't give much thought to what Speedy meant culturally, really, until I started writing the show Six Mexicans Named Gonzalez. I discovered that there weren't many positive or heroic images of Latinos and Mexican-Americans in particular throughout the last, you know, 50, 60 years of popular entertainment, except for Speedy Gonzalez. Unfortunately, I don't know if much has changed since the time the original cartoons were produced. So everybody I talk to that's Latino has a special place. You know, when I ask them about Speedy Gonzalez, nobody dislikes Speedy Gonzalez.
But, I mean, come on. Is Speedy Gonzalez occasionally racist? I mean, the cohorts were not a particularly impressive group of mice.
I don't see anything as necessarily black and white, but I think the bigger presence of the character and what he represents, I think, overwhelms the concerns for the supporting characters, which are not always in the cartoons. And I think it's somewhat negligible. That's my opinion.
Well, we know what Speedy sounds like. He sounds like this.
Arriba, arriba, ángale, ángale, ole, 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 ángale. Hello, pussycat. You looking for a nice fat mouse for dinner?
But when you do him in your act, you know, you do Speedy Gonzalez when he's out of character. And,
right.
And how does that Speedy sound?
I know what part of them. I could do the part of Mama that actually addresses that.
Mm-hmm.
Recognize me? Ah, I think you do, amigo. That's right. Soy yo. Soy Speedy Gonzalez. Ah, why do you look so surprised? Ah, it's the voice, isn't it? Yes, that throws quite a lot of people, I'm afraid. But you didn't really think I talk like in the cartoons, did you? Oh, no, no, no. I do not talk like that anymore. Make no mistake. What you are hearing is the voice of a veteran mouse thespian with years of training in the classical arts of elocution y proyección, and 3 semesters worth of English as a second language.
Now, you never play Speedy doing his cartoon Speedy accent, right?
No. You know, in the rest of the monologue, he begins to explain his humble beginnings, and basically that character that he played in the cartoons was just that, a character. Like, he goes, you see, previously I had been offered nothing but the typical degrading Mexican stereotype roles, you know, the sniveling and cowardly farm mouse, or the evil switchblade-carrying sewer rat. But when I read this script, I said, ah, now here's something fresh, something new, a Mexican character con power, corazón y fuego, a lone mouse, a proverbial every Mexican, if you will, a defender of the weak who is constantly battling the injustices of La Sistema, embodied in the character of the evil gringo gato, and who, against all odds, always ends up triumphant in the final frame. A character who is brash, fearless, and crafty, a fighter, and a lover. In short, a character who was all the things that I already was. I kind of projected a lot of cultural responsibility onto the fictionalization, you know, of his real character, alter ego, whatever, you know.
And part of what you're saying is, right now there aren't a lot of positive Latino images out there, and he may be animated, but he's still the best there is.
I never thought I'd be having this deep of a conversation about Speedy Gonzalez. It's amazing, but the most popular Latino character in the history of popular culture is Speedy Gonzalez. You know, he's always messing with this gringo gato. He's always talking so much trash, and yet he still lives from episode to episode. So in that sense, he's practically a subversive revolutionary. You know, granted, yes, he is a cartoon character, but, you know, we'll take whatever we can get.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Adrian Viejas is an Austin-based comic whose one-man show is called 6 Mexicans Named Gonzalez.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers, with Sean Landis and Michael Cavanaugh, engineered by George Edwards and Dylan Keefe, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Jim Colgan and Lou Olkowski. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large. Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
I go take my siesta now.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the Bidell Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.